It must have cost him a fortune. Thanks. You too. That is, I mean, you look well for the circumstances, given all that's happened. I know what you mean. I reach over and pat his hand to reassure him. He gives me a smile. He looks like he wants to say something more, then decides against it and turns his eyes away. It takes a half hour for everyone to find their seats, and another half hour for the waiters to start arriving with plates of food. I don't eat anything. Commander Jameson sits opposite me on the far side of our banquet table, and between her and Thomas are three of my Drake classmates. I exchange a strained smile with them. On my left side is a man named Chan, who organizes and oversees all trials taken in Los Angeles. He administered mine. What I don't understand is why he's here, why he even cares that Mateus died. He's a former acquaintance of our parents, so his presence is not unexpected. But why right next to me? Then I remember that Chan had mentored Mateus before he joined Commander Jameson's squad. Mateus hated him. The man now furrows his bushy eyebrows at me and claps a hand on my bare shoulder. It lingers there for a while. "How are you feeling, my dear?" he asks. His words distort the scars on his face, a slice across the bridge of his nose, and another jagged mark that goes from his ear to the bottom of his chin. I manage a smile. Better than expected. "Well, I'll say." He lets out a laugh that makes me cringe. His eyes look me up and down. "That dress polishes you up like a fresh snow blossom." It takes all my control to keep the smile on my face. "Stay calm," I tell myself. Chan is not a man to make into an enemy. "I loved your brother very much, you know," he continues with overdone sympathy. "I remember him as a kid. You should have seen him. He used to run around your parents' living room, holding out his hand like a little gun. He was destined to enter our squads." "Thank you, sir," I say. Chan saws off a huge piece of steak and shoves it in his mouth. "Mateus was very attentive during the time I mentored him. Natural leader. Did he ever tell you about that?" A memory flashes through my mind. The rainy night when Mateus first started working for Chan. He had taken me and Thomas, who was still in school, out to the Tanegashi sector, where I ate my first bowl of pork edamame with spaghetti and sweet onion rolls. I remember the two of them were in full uniform, Mateus with his jacket open and shirt hanging loose, Thomas neatly buttoned up with his hair carefully slicked back. Thomas teased me over my messy pigtails, but Mateus was quiet. Then a week later, his apprenticeship with Chan ended abruptly. Mateus had filed an appeal, and he was reassigned to Commander Jameson's patrol. "He said it was all classified," I lie. Chan laughs. "A good boy that Mateus was, a great apprentice. Imagine my disappointment when he was reassigned to the city patrols. He told me he just didn't have the smarts to judge the trials or organize the kids who finished taking them. Such a modest one, always smarter than he thought he was, just like you." He grins at me. I nod. Chan made me take the trial twice because I got a perfect score in record time, 1 hour, 10 minutes. He thought I had cheated. Not only do I have the only perfect score in the nation, I'm probably also the only kid who has ever taken the trial twice. "You are very kind," I reply. "My brother was a better leader than I'll ever be." Chan shushes me with a wave of his hand. "Nonsense, my dear," he says. Then he leans uncomfortably close. There's something oily and unpleasant about him. "I'm personally devastated by the way he died," he says. "At the hands of that nasty boy. What a shame." Chan narrows his eyes, making his eyebrows look even bushier. "I was so pleased when Commander Jameson told me that you'd be tracking him. His case needs a pair of fresh eyes, and you're just the doll to do it. What a gem of a test mission, eh?" I hate him with all my being. Thomas notices my stiffness because I feel his hand cover mine under the table. "Just go with it," he's trying to tell me. When Chan finally turns away from me to answer a question from the man on his other side, Thomas leans toward me. Jan has a personal grudge against Day, he whispers. Is that so? I whisper back. He nods. Who do you think gave him that scar? Day did? I can't keep the surprise from my face. Chan is a rather large man and has worked for the trials administration for as long as I can remember. He's a skilled official. Could a teenage boy really wound him like that and get away with it? I glance over at Chan and study the scar. It's a clean cut made with a smooth-edged blade. Must have happened quickly, too, to be such a straight line. I can't imagine Chan holding still while someone sliced him like that. For a moment, just a split second, I'm on Day's side. I glance up at Commander Jameson, who stares at me as if she's reading my thoughts. It makes me uneasy. Thomas's hand touches mine again. Hey, he says. Day can't hide from the government forever. Sooner or later, we'll dig that street rat out and make an example out of him. He's no match for you, especially when you put your mind to something. Thomas's kind smile makes me weak, and suddenly I feel like Mateus is the one sitting next to me and telling me everything is going to be okay, reassuring me that the Republic won't fail me. My brother had once promised to stay at my side forever. I look away from Thomas and toward the altar so he doesn't see the tears in my eyes. I don't think I'll ever smile again. Let's get this over with, I whisper.
Day. It's gaudy hot even this late in the afternoon. I limp through the streets along the rim of Alta and Winter Sector, along the lake and out in the open, lost in the crowded shuffle of other people. My wounds are still healing. I wear the army trousers our caretaker gave me with a thin collared shirt Tess found in a garbage bin. My cap is pulled low, and I've added to my disguise with a bandage patch over my left eye. Nothing unusual, really. Not in this sea of workers with factory injuries. Today I'm out on my own. Tess is keeping a low profile several streets down, tucked away on a hidden second-floor ledge. Never any reason to risk both of us if I don't have to. Familiar noises surround me. Street vendors call out to passers-by, selling boiled goose eggs and fried dough and hot dogs. Attendants linger at the doors of grocery stores and coffee shops, trying to win customers over. A decades-old car rattles by. The second-shift workers are slowly making their way home. A few girls notice me and blush when I look at them. Boats chug around the lake, careful to avoid the giant water turbines churning along the edge, and the shore's flood sirens are quiet and unlit. Some areas are blocked off. These I steer clear of. The soldiers have marked them as quarantine zones. The loudspeakers that line the roofs of the buildings crackle and pop, and jumbotrons pause in their ads, or, in some cases, warnings about another Patriot rebel attack, to show a video of our flag. Everyone stops in the streets and goes still as the pledge starts. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the great Republic of America, to our Elector Primo, to our glorious states, to unity against the colonies, to our impending victory. When the Elector Primo's name comes on, we salute toward the Capitol. I mumble the pledge under my breath, but stay silent in the last two passages when the street police aren't looking my way. I wonder what the pledge sounded like before we went to war against the colonies. When the pledge ends, life resumes. I go to a Chinese-themed bar covered in graffiti. The attendant at the door gives me a wide smile that's missing several teeth and quickly ushers me in. "We have real Tsingtao beer today," he murmurs. "Leftover cases from an imported gift sent straight to our glorious elector himself. Goes until 6 o'clock. His eyes dart around nervously as he says this. I just stare at him. Tsingtao beer? Yeah, right. My father would have laughed. The Republic didn't sign an import deal with China, or as the Republic likes to claim, conquered China and took over its businesses just to send quality imports to the slum sectors. More likely, this guy's pretty far behind in paying his bi-monthly government taxes. No other reason to risk slapping fake Tsingtao labels on bottles of his homebrew. I thank the man, though, and step inside. This is as good a place as any to dig up information. It's dark. The air smells like pipe smoke and fried meat and gas lamps. I bump my way through the mess of tables and chairs, snatching food from a couple of unguarded plates as I go, and stuffing it beneath my shirt, until I reach the bar. Behind me, a large circle of customers are cheering on a skiz fight. Guess this bar tolerates illegal gambling. If they're smart, they'll be ready at any minute to bribe the street police with their winnings, unless they're willing to admit out loud that they're making tax-free money. The bartender doesn't bother to check my age. She doesn't even look at me.
"What'll it be?"
she asks. I shake my head. "Just some water, please," I say. Behind us, I hear a huge roar of cheers as one of the fighters goes down. She gives me a skeptical glance. Her eyes immediately shift to the bandage on my face.
"What happened to your eye, kid?"
"Terrace accident. I tend cows." She makes a disgusted face, but now she seems interested in me.
"What a shame. Sure you don't want a beer to go with that?"
"Must hurt." I shake my head again. "Thanks, cousin, but I don't drink. I like to stay alert." She smiles at me. She's kind of pretty in the flickering lamplight, with glittering green powder over her smooth-lidded eyes and a short, black, bobbed haircut. A vine tattoo snakes down her neck and disappears into her corseted shirt. A dirty pair of goggles, probably protection against bar fights, hangs around her neck. Kind of a shame. If I weren't busy hunting for information, I'd take my time with this girl, chat her up, and maybe get a kiss, or three, out of her.
"Lake boy, yeah?" she asks. "Just decided to waltz in here and break a few girls' hearts? Or are you fighting?"
She nods her head toward the skiz fight. I grin. "I'll leave that to you.
What makes you think I fight?"
I nod at the scars on her arms and the bruises on her hands. She gives me a slow smile. I shrug after a moment. "I wouldn't be caught dead in one of those rings. Just taking a break from the sun. You seem like nice company, you know? I mean, as long as you don't have the plague." A universal joke, but she still laughs. She leans on the counter.
"I live on the sector's edge. Pretty safe there so far."
I lean toward her. "You're lucky then." I grow serious. "A family I know had their door marked recently."
"Sorry to hear it."
"I want to ask you something, just out of curiosity. You heard anything about a man around here in the last few days? Someone who says he has plague meds?" She raises an eyebrow at me.
"Yeah, I heard about that. There's a bunch of people trying to find him."
"Do you know what he's been telling people?" She hesitates for a moment. I notice that she has a few tiny freckles on her nose.
"I hear he's telling people he wants to give a plague cure to someone. One person only. That this person will know who he's talking about."
I pretend to look amused.
"Lucky person, yeah?"
She grins.
"No kidding. He said he wants this person to meet him at midnight, tonight, at the 10-second place."
10-second place? The bartender shrugs.
"Hell if I know what that means. Neither does anyone else, for that matter."
She leans over the counter toward me and lowers her voice.
"Know what I think? I think this guy's just crazy."
I laugh along with her, but my mind is spinning. I have no doubt now that this person is searching for me. Almost a year ago, I broke into an Arcadia bank through the alley that runs behind it. One of the security guards tried to kill me. When he spat at me and told me I'd be cut to pieces by the bank vault's lasers, I taunted him. I told him that it would take me 10 seconds to break into that vault room. He didn't believe me. But the thing is, no one ever believes what I say until I actually end up doing it. I bought myself a nice pair of boots with that money, and even shopped for an electro bomb on the black market, a weapon that disables guns in its vicinity. Came in handy when I attacked an airbase. And Tess got an entire outfit. Brand new shirts and shoes and pants, and bandages and rubbing alcohol and even a bottle of aspirin. We both got a good amount of food. The rest I gave to my family and other lake folks. After several more minutes of flirting, I say goodbye to the bartender girl and leave. The sun's still in the sky, and I can feel beads of sweat on my face. I know enough now. The government must have found something at the hospital and wants to lure me into a trap. They'll send a guy to the 10-second place at midnight, and then place soldiers along the back alley. I bet they think I'm real desperate. They'll probably also bring along plague meds, though, to tempt me out into the open. I press my lips together in thought. Then I change the direction I'm walking. Off to the financial district. I have an appointment to keep.
June. 11:29 p.m., Batala Sector, 72 degrees Fahrenheit indoors. The lights in Batala Hall are cold and fluorescent. I dress in a bathroom on the observation and analysis floor. I'm wearing long black sleeves inside a striped black vest, slender black pants tucked into boots, and a long black robe that wraps around my shoulders and covers me like a blanket. A white stripe runs down the center of it, all the way to the floor. A black mask covers my face, and infrared goggles shield my eyes. Other than that, all I have is a tiny microphone and an even tinier earpiece. And a gun, just in case. I need to look genderless, generic, unidentifiable. I need to look like a black market dealer, someone rich enough to afford plague cures. Mateus would have shaken his head at me. "You can't go alone on a classified mission, June," he would say. "You might get hurt." How ironic. I tighten the clasp that holds my cloak in place, steel sprayed with bronze, probably imported from West Texas, then head off towards the stairs that will take me outside Batala Hall and down towards the Arcadia Bank where I'm supposed to meet Day. My brother has been dead for 120 hours. It already feels like forever. 70 hours ago, I gained clearance to search the internet and found out as much about Day as I could. 40 hours ago, I laid out a plan for tracking Day to Commander Jameson. 32 hours ago, she approved it. I doubt she even remembers what it is. 30 hours ago, I sent one scout to every plague-infected sector in Los Angeles, Winter, Blue Ridge, Lake, and Alta. They spread the word. Someone has a plague medicine for you. Come to the 10-second place. 29 hours ago, I attended my brother's funeral. I do not plan on catching Day tonight. I don't even plan on seeing him. He'll know exactly where the 10-second place is, and that I'm either an agent sent by the government or by the black market dealers that pay taxes to the government. He's not going to show his face. Even Commander Jameson, who's testing me with this first task, knows we won't get a glimpse of him. But I know he's going to be there. He needs plague meds desperately enough. And him showing up is all I hope for tonight. A clue, a starting point, a narrower direction, something personal about this boy criminal. I'm careful not to walk under the street lamps. In fact, I would have traveled by rooftop if I weren't going to the financial sector, where guards line the roofs. All around me, the jumbotrons blare their colorful campaigns, the sound of their ads distorted and jolty from the city speakers. One of them shows an updated profile of Day, this time featuring a boy with long black hair. Next to the jumbotrons are flickering streetlights, and under those walk crowds of night shift workers, police, and merchants. Every now and then, a tank rolls through, followed by several platoons of troops. They have blue stripes on their sleeves, soldiers back from the war front, or soldiers rotating out to the war front. They keep their guns by their sides with both hands on the weapon. They all look like Mateus to me, and I have to breathe a little harder, walk a little faster, anything to stay focused. I take the long way through Batala, through the sector's side roads and abandoned buildings, not stopping until I'm a good distance outside of military grounds. The street police won't know I'm on a mission. If they see me dressed like this, equipped with infrared goggles, they'll question me for sure. The Arcadia Bank lies on a quiet street. I go around the bank's backside until I'm standing in front of a parking lot at the end of an alleyway. There, I wait in the shadows. My goggles wash most of the color out of the scene. I look around and see rows of city speakers on the roofs, a stray cat whose tail twitches over the lid of a trash can, an abandoned kiosk with old anti-colonies bulletins tacked all over it. The clock on my visor says 11:53 p.m. I pass the time by forcing myself to think through Day's history. Before the robbery at this bank, Day had already appeared on our records 3 times. Those were only the incidents where we found fingerprints. I can only guess at the number of other crimes he's committed. I take a closer look at the bank's alleyway. How did he break into this bank in 10 seconds, with 4 armed guards at the back entrance? The alley is narrow. He could have found enough footholds to jump his way up to the walls to the second or third floors, all while using the guards' weapons against them. Probably got them to shoot at each other. Probably smashed through a window. That would have taken just a few seconds. What he did once he got inside, I have no idea. I already know how agile Day is. Surviving a 2.5-story fall proves that much. He won't have a chance to do that tonight, though. I don't care how light he is on his feet. You don't just jump out of buildings and then expect to be able to walk properly afterwards. Day won't be scampering up walls and stairwells for at least another week. Suddenly, I tense up. It's 12:02 a.m. A clicking sound echoes from somewhere far away, and the cat sitting on the trash can makes a run for it. It could be a cigarette lighter, a gun trigger, the speakers, or a flickering streetlight. It could be anything. I scan the roofs. Nothing yet. But the hairs on the back of my neck rise. I know he's here. I know he's watching me. "Come out," I say. The tiny microphone at my mouth makes my voice sound like a man's. Silence. Not even the kiosk's layers of paper bulletins move. There's no wind tonight. I remove a vial from a holster at my belt. My other hand doesn't leave the handle of my gun. "I have what you need," I say, and wave around the vial for emphasis. Still nothing. This time, however, I hear what sounds like the faintest sigh. A breath. My eyes dart to the speakers lining the roofs. That's what the clicking sound was. He's rewired the speakers so he can talk to me without giving away his location. I smile behind my mask. It's what I would have done. "I know you need this," I say, gesturing again at the vial. I turn it in my hands and hold it higher. It has all its official labels, the stamp of approval. I assure you it's the real thing. Another breath. "Someone you care about will wish you'd come out to greet me." I look at the time on my goggles. "It's 12:05. I'll give you 2 minutes, then I leave." The alley falls silent again. Every now and then, I hear another faint breath from the loudspeakers. My eyes shift from the time on my visor to the shadows of the roofs. He's clever. I can't tell where he's broadcasting from. It could be on this street. It could be several blocks down from a higher floor. But I know he's close enough to see me himself. The time on my visor shows 12:07. I turn, tuck the vial back into my belt, and start to walk away.
"What do you want for the cure, cousin?"
The voice is barely a whisper, but through the speakers it sounds broken and startling, so crackly that I have trouble understanding him. Details race instantly through my mind. Male. He has a light accent. He's not from Oregon or Nevada or Arizona or New Mexico or West Texas or any other republic state. Native Southern Californian. He uses the familiar term cousin, something Lake Sector civilians often use.